Accession number 26868, Real 8.
One did hear certain things from people who were shot down and got back. But generally it was you had an escape kit which had money in it, maps and so on, which we are supposed to carry on at all times and never open. In fact, that if you opened it and took the money out, it was a court-martial offence. I'll come to that later, because I got caught on that one. So when they were told, right, to just follow that and do the usual thing, which was name and number. That was all.
You're mentioning, obviously, bailing out, and you mentioned, and I've spoken to a couple of people who have been injured in that process. What was your experience in relation to how you could avoid being injured in that experience?
I think follow the advice given for different planes, and because different planes had different procedures.
Can you give us an example?
The Hurricane was pretty good on a belly landing. You didn't have much trouble there. Unless there were trees or obstructions in front of you. The Spitfire without the cannons was fair. You had about a 50-50 chance with that. But the ones with the cannons, they would try to stick into the ground in a belly landing as well as one landing with an undercarriage semi-locked, because the wheels went out and down went the nose. I must say the one dogfight in I think it was Sicily, where when we looked up, there were, at this one moment, there was something like 10 parachutes visible at the same time, people coming down, both from both sides.
You mentioned to me off air the dangers of jumping out of the plane. People talked of being hit by the tailplane. What experience did you have of that, or what did you know of certain planes that were more susceptible for that happening?
I was fairly lucky that I never had to jump out, although I was always prepared, and I got prepared to go out once, and then I found the engine kept going. The Mustang, for example, if you bailed out the same way as you did with a Hurricane or a Spitfire, you almost invariably hit the tailplane, which usually crippled people so much that they were unable to pull their ripcord, so that they were a loss. The way this was overcome was to trim the aircraft very much nose heavy, hold the nose up with the control column, having let your hood, jettisoned your hood and undone your straps and undone your microphone so that you didn't go out and strangle yourself. And then when you were ready, let go of the stick, and the aircraft dived down very quickly, propelling the pilot out rather on the lines of an injection seat. That proved fairly effective. Later on, when we're talking about the Mustang Squadron, I'll tell you an unusual occurrence of one chap trying to bail out the wrong way.
Okay.
I'll leave that until later on.
In relation to your experience, in relation to going off to your new operational duty, what was it like to be back in operations again?
Well, I think perhaps I'd better explain a little bit more, expand on it a bit. This other chap and I arrived together on a terrible, grey, drizzly day, and everything in the squadron was doom and gloom. We found that four pilots and four planes had gone missing the day before. Just before we arrived, four more planes and pilots had gone missing. And that was only just a beginning. This squadron, CO was a sick man, he'd been shot down twice and so on, and his nerve had gone, and he was had boils, he couldn't fly. The various people who had been promoted to do this, that, the other, and the whole squadron was in a very sad state. It had been one of the leading ones on activities, but had really fallen into a trap. And it was rather interesting to go into a squadron like that. And perhaps I'll tell you a little bit. The first thing that the chaps did was tried to frighten me. What a terrible plane the Mustang was, that if you did anything except what they said, you'd kill yourself and so on. And I thought, oh, this is just rubbish. They're trying to cover up here. So the next day I went out to have my first flight in a Mustang. I hadn't been in one before. And being a single-seater, you're just told what the various speeds for taking off and landing are and controls and so on, the way you go on your own. Having heard all this rubbish these fellows were talking about, they said that you had to drag it in rather like an airliner, not like the way the normal fighter aircraft were landed, and if you did a glide landing, you'd kill yourself and so on. So I came in the normal way and they shot red lights, so I went and did it their way, drag, which was ridiculous. So I taxied back to them and said, no more red lights or I'll really create about this. I'll show you how it should be landed. I've done one landing. I'll show you a proper way to land the thing, and then I'll do a glide landing, which you say you kill anybody. So I did the landing my way, took off round and did a glide landing. All these people just disappeared. But their morale was shot. The whole lot on the squadron were not very good. There were one or two amongst them who were reasonable, but the rest were not the type that I would like to come in contact with on the squadron because of their attitude. So I did a bit more flying with that, and I was ready to go off on an ops. And I think it was about the second day I was told the group captain was waiting for me in the mess, so I went up and we introduced ourselves, and he was just welcoming me to the wing. And I'll come to what the wing was in a moment or two. And said he was very glad I'd come in because I had a dual thing. One was stiffening up what was going on in the squadron, and the other thing was to recommend pilots who would be capable of doing the job. And as I'd been in training command, I probably knew a fair number, which I did. So I gave him so many names, and these fellows were brought out very quickly. So in no time at all, I had quite a number of people that I knew coming in. Perhaps I'll break a little bit there and tell you a bit about the squadron and the wing and so on.
Before we do, wasn't it possible to change people's morale once they'd adopted this negative attitude?
Some people yes, some people no.
Are you able to explain why?
Well, some, I think, prize their own skins a little bit more highly than others. Putting it probably rather mildly. But unfortunately, once that sort of attitude is in a group of people, it's inclined to stick. It's very difficult to get rid of it.
Well, some people might say that that's actually not such a bad attitude to have. Survival of the fittest and all.
Well, the strange thing was that I found that people who were defensive got shot down more often than people who were aggressive. And there was quite a big gap between the two. I was going to tell you about the squadron. We went to this 213 squadron, which together with 249 was the fighter bomber force for Balkan Air Force. Now, Balkan Air Force was a new thing that had been set up just about the time of D-Day, or shortly after. And its main object was to harass and stop the German occupation, army of occupation, of Greece and surrounding territory, to stop that army from reaching Germany and joining the other German forces fighting the Allies from Normandy onwards through Belgium and so on. They didn't have enough army to effect another landing in Yugoslavia or somewhere around there. So it was up to the Air Force to try and stop that army getting into the conflict in Europe, in the main part of Europe. So the two fighter bombers squadrons were to go out with bombs, bomb bridges, roads and rails on escarpments to make landslides, anything that just stopped their progress on their retreat. And when the bombs were dropped, to then use the ammunition that one carried in the gun bays for train busting, shooting up motor transport, and anything that would delay that army reaching what it was trying to do, join up in Europe. So that basically was the aim of Balkan Air Force.
Let's talk about, if we might, be able to talk about that the instances where you were involved in strafing.
Oh, right from the beginning, though, I think my first trip on Mustangs and so on, I did as a leader of a group of... Wait a while, I'll go back. I mentioned earlier two lots of four pilots and aircraft disappearing on two consecutive days, which meant almost half of the pilots and aircraft on the squadron were gone in that time. Now, Yugoslavia is on the trailing tip, as far as the weather pattern goes, of the Alps. So the weather there is probably some of the worst in the world. It changes so quickly, alters. You can have almost a cloudless day and 20 minutes later there's cloud from ground to 30,000 feet. And why those 8 aircraft and pilots had disappeared was not enemy action. It was weather. And pilots not properly trained for flying in that weather. So on discussions, we decided that the only thing to do was to go out in formations of 4 and stick to those formations, apart from the actual bombing when you could see. And when it came to, if it came to going through cloud, to go through cloud in formation, which meant that the formation flying had to be pretty spot on. But unfortunately, there was no time to be able to teach these people cloud flying. Earlier in the thing, I mentioned how training in Rhodesia had been very good from the point of view of learning how to fly in cloud and making the most of it. So that we were restricted in leaders to the ones who were good at cloud flying and the ability to be able to lead, because the leader had every responsibility with people flying in close formation. He had to be the one to look out. He had to navigate. And at the same time, fly in such a way that the people formating on him could continue to formate on him.
Can you describe what it was like to fly Mustang in relation to all the other planes you've been involved with?
Interesting. It had exactly the same engine. It was a Rolls-Royce Merlin, built by Packard in America under license to Merlin, to Rolls-Royce. So it was exactly the same engine as was in the Spitfire 9s. But it had a high-speed wing, and it was a later addition in wings. It was able to carry about 4 times the amount of bombs. It had about 4 times the amount of ammunition and nearly 4 times the amount of fuel. So it was a much heavier aircraft, but it handled very, very well. And it took off in much the same distance as a Spitfire, not quite as quickly because of the extra weight. But it, with this high-speed wing, which was meant it, I can't remember the term they gave this wing, but the top surface of the wing was exactly the same shape as the bottom surface of the wing. And it had a very narrow leading edge and a very narrow trailing edge, which meant the drag was very much less. And what happened was that it built up speed very much quicker, and its cruising speed was nearly 50% up on the Spitfire. So it was quite interesting, and it was a very, very good, because of its extra weight and stability, it was a very good gun platform for strafing. And it took off. Initially we were using 2 500 pound bombs, whereas the Spitfires were only taking 2 250 pound bombs. And later on we altered to carrying 2 by 1,000-pound bombs, which was a pretty fair load for an aircraft with only 30-something feet wingspan. But it took off very easily with those and flew very well. The only problem you really had was with a 1,000-pound bomb was if you actually started on a dive bombing and you suddenly saw that the target was not what you expected or was covered in red crosses, pulling up again with that amount of bombs on was a little bit hectic. So you want to know about strafing. Well, I can't remember just what I did on the first bombing run I did with three people in formation on me, but we dropped the bombs on the target. Some went astray, some were got near. But as this was a group who hadn't flown together before and so on, it wasn't too bad. Then we went looking for targets to strafe and also to see what it was like, really, in those conditions. We didn't have a lot of success to begin with on the first run, but I think it was about the third trip I did, there was tremendous emphasis put on trying to knock out a bridge near Zagreb, because all the trains carrying all the equipment were going through Zagreb. So I went in the dive. I'm ahead of myself. In dive bombing, you approach the target and you couldn't actually, at speed, push the nose down and get onto your target because you were doing a reverse loop, more or less. So what you did was slowed up and did a stall turn, so you went, turned right over and went down. And the aim was to be in about a 70% dive, vertical being 90. The steeper the dive, the more accurate you are likely to be. And you dive down, heading for the target, and then you lifted the nose over the target to give a little bit of impetus forward on the bombs, and you had no bomb aiming equipment or anything like this. This was purely seat of the pants, trial and error business, and then pressed your switch and let the bombs go. So on this bridge just south of Zagreb, I went lower than normal. I continued the dive further down, let the bombs go, turned round to look, and saw them go right through the bridge. I was very disappointed to see the rails were still going through. But it was given as a direct hit. Everybody confirmed that it was a direct hit. The strange thing was the bridge was not used again, so obviously it had taken the foundations out. And then we went strafing, and each time we went out we were getting better at it.
What's the feeling like in relation to being in that position? Here you are, flying a Mustang, got all the power in the air, and people on the ground are...
Well, it was fairly elating. On the other hand, when tracers started flying around you, you really realised it wasn't altogether a party. What one tried to do was, if a road was going straight ahead of me, you didn't go down the road that way because people could shoot at you. You tried to go across. And likewise with trains, you try to do it from the side. Initially, after the first few trips, we found that the trains were pretty much sitting ducks. You could blow the 0.5 ammunition we were using was 0.5 guns, and the ammunition was armor-piercing incendiary. And that armor-piercing was capable of going into the boilers of the trains. And you tried to hit near the firebox in the boiler to do the maximum amount of damage. So that for a while we were knocking off a hell of a lot of trains. Excuse me. You'd see when the bullets started to bounce or go through, the steam coming out, and then the steam going into the firebox, and clouds of black smoke coming out through the funnel, and so on. And the train would grind to a halt. The Germans then decided that to keep the trains going, they had to put on more protection. So they used these flak cars, which were low loaders, which they surrounded up to a height of about 5 or 6 feet with steel plate, and then had on these low loaders half a dozen guns to try and combat the Mustangs. So that from when they started to come on the thing, you had to first of all knock out the flak car before you could really attack the engine. Otherwise, if you were attacking the engine, they had a free run at you, and you were more than likely to be shot down. I think, I remember correctly, in 1 month I had about 30 engines that I disabled, train engines. That was until the flak cars became so popular with the Germans. Then it was a bit more difficult. Strafing, we found that we did best on their motor transport. We were able to cross the roads, knock off two or three on one pass, come back, knock off two or three. But you knew that all the chaps there were firing all sorts of guns, and a chap who just stood there and pulled the trigger like that was just as bad as likely to hit you as the fellow who aimed at you. So that there were random shots going all directions, and you were likely to pick up quite a number of holes through your aircraft. I think I had 6 different aircrafts in 1 week because of holes through them. And also, some of it was caused by the plane itself. In strafing the trains, there's all this ballast, these stones on the railway line, and the armor-piercing bullets hitting this would fling the stones in the air, and then you'd fly through the stones, so that they damaged the wings.
Presumably the danger for you was that one dead-eyed dick would actually get you through the cockpit, for instance.
Yes, I had that once. There was this bang underneath. I got a burn on the elbow, right elbow. Then this bullet went through the top of my radio, and later was found in the bottom of the cockpit. And I thought, that damn thing's gone through the radiator, because the radiator was below the pilot. And what had happened, in retrospect, was that it had been fired from underneath, missed the radiator, was coming straight for me, hit the round tubing that the which was steel that the seat moved up and down on, which diverted it. And it just brushed my elbow and went round. By this time it had lost most of its momentum. So that I did have it once. I got ready to let the hood go and was watching the radiator thermometer. But I was fortunate.